From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As Ariel Sharon takes power in Israel, we'll hear a talk by Edward Said about his experience as a Palestinian in exile. And at the Super Bowl, more than 100,000 people had the images of their faces sent deep into the stadium to a police control booth. We'll take a look at the issue of privacy. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, taking a first swing at knocking down the toll booth on the road to the middle class. President George W. Bush's words today sent his 10-year, $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal to a divided Congress. The tax relief package, the largest in two decades, has met with skepticism from opposition Democrats who say it's too big, and with undisguised glee from some of Bush's Republican colleagues who say it could be even bigger. Democrats contend most of the dollars in Bush's tax cut go to the wealthiest Americans and propose instead between $750 and $900 billion in tax cuts targeted at the neediest. Working to slow the tax train that left the station last week when the Congressional Budget Office estimated a federal government surplus of $5.6 trillion over the next decade, $1 trillion more than previously anticipated, Democrats argued that Bush's cut will deplete the nation's coffers. A New York Democrat, Michael McNulty, said, "The last time I saw a tax cut of this size coupled with proposals for significant increases in defense spending was 20 years ago in the first term of Ronald Reagan." In a challenge to big drug manufacturers, an Indian company is offering to supply AIDS drugs to a medical relief agency at 3.5% of the cost charged in Western countries, as long as they're distributed for free. The Bombay Cipla Limited will sell the three-drug antiretroviral cocktail to Doctors Without Borders for $350 a year per patient instead of the $10,000 to $15,000 charged in the United States and Europe. The decision could revolutionize the treatment of HIV patients in developing countries where the virus is most rampant, but it's unclear if the companies holding patents on the drugs will go along. Bristol-Myers Squibb, GlaxoSmithKline, and Boehringer Ingelheim all hold patents on the drugs in the cocktail. Under WTO rules, if a country fails to enforce international patent laws, punitive trade sanctions could be imposed. But whether the big drug companies pressure their national governments to bring a case in the WTO remains to be seen. Radical French farm leader José Bové stood trial today on charges of raiding a research center and destroying genetically modified rice plants in the latest action by anti-globalization activists. Bové shot to fame in 1999 when he led an attack on a McDonald's restaurant in southern France to protest against corporate-led globalization in general and U.S. tariffs on French cheese in particular. Today in France, several hundred protesters marched to the court with Bové, who faces up to 5 years in prison and a fine if convicted of breaking into the CIRAD Research Institute in the southern city of Montpellier, France, in June 1999 and damaging public property. Bové told journalists, "Today we do not need to burn our hand in a flame to know that there is a danger. The experiments confirming the danger are more than sufficient." Only 2 days after Ariel Sharon won power, Israel rejected a Palestinian call to pick up peace talks where they left off. A new Israeli advisor said today that everything that was spoken about or said is not binding on Israel or any government. The Palestinian Authority had called yesterday for the resumption of negotiations, quote, from the point they have reached. The Russian parliament gave early approval to a Kremlin-sponsored bill that sets tough rules for forming and funding political parties, provisions critics assail as state interference. President Vladimir Putin has said the bill would promote the creation of effective political parties. Opponents contend it would push most of Russia's parties out of existence and make the rest dependent on government handouts. Under the bill, a political party must have at least 10,000 members nationwide and no fewer than 100 members in more than half of Russia's 89 provinces. Parties that receive more than 3% of the vote would receive state financing. The bill allows some private donations, but sharply limits their size and who can give. Russia has some 200 parties on paper. 26 groups contested the 1999 parliamentary election. And finally, this news from Vietnam. Two important coffee-growing provinces in Vietnam's central highlands were tense yesterday after several days of land and rights protests by thousands of ethnic minority people. The protests in the provinces of Dak Lak and Gia Lai were the biggest known for years. Residents and diplomats said the protests appeared to have been started by disputes, including land encroachment by members of the Vietnamese majority. The relocation of large numbers of lowland-residing Vietnamese people to the highlands has created friction with members of ethnic groups who have lived there for generations. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Super Bowl fans never knew it, but police video cameras focused on their faces, one by one, as they streamed through the turnstiles in Tampa, Florida last week. Cables instantly carried the biometric images to computers, which spent less than a second comparing them with thousands of digital portraits of known criminals and suspected terrorists. In a control booth deep inside the stadium, the police watched and waited for a match. What's this surveillance all about? And, what about the increasing monitoring of our lives, our internet surfing habits, medical records, following us perhaps by cell phone, intercepting email? We're joined by a number of experts to talk about it. Let's begin with David Banasar of Privacy International. What's your reaction to the Super Bowl surveillance?
Well, from what we know, the police, in conjunction with the NFL and a couple of private companies, set up a video surveillance system that wasn't just your standard video cameras. These cameras actually had specialized software that were designed to identify people based on what their faces look like and then compare those faces with a database of photographs. And they did this for several days looking for people, and it appears that the only person that they were able to identify was a suspected scalper who they then tried to chase down, and he'd already left. So it doesn't even seem like it was a particularly successful test, but nonetheless, they were scanning and keeping track of thousands of people simultaneously who had never done anything wrong.
Now, apparently, this was for a Massachusetts company that just wanted to test its technology so it can sell it to law enforcement around the country.
Well, I mean, it's all fine and well for them to test it, but they should get consent from people before they start secretly monitoring them. People going to the Super Bowl shouldn't be their test bed guinea pigs for doing this.
Mark Unkerfer, you work for the Industry Trade Group, Information Technology Association of America in Arlington, Virginia. What's your response?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to address. Obviously, I focus more on the online. Part of the challenge is to get consent in a manner that's not intrusive. That's why on the online world, we look to having technology tools that allow to kind of do automatic tracking of whether or not what a particular website meets a consumer's privacy preferences. It's kind of hard for me to comment on how you could possibly have gotten consent from 80,000 plus people. It does seem that we're going to be able to do that in the online world using the technology of P3P, which will be incorporated in most browsers in a fairly short order.
Jason Catlett, your group, Junk Busters, is concerned about privacy issues. What do you think about Super Bowl surveillance?
Yeah, I track mainly the use of marketing data about people, and governments are a primary source of that. There have been some cases where, for example, supermarkets have gone out with men in white coats and written down the license plates of the cars of shoppers who shop in the supermarket and then look it up in government databases. And that, I think, is another example of how gathering of information without people's consent is really unacceptable. And what is necessary is to have a law that requires institutions such as the Super Bowl stadium, such as government agencies, and such as direct marketers to obtain the consent of people before collecting data about them.
Mark Unkefer, what about that issue of letting people know what's happening?
Sure. I think one of the things that we really ought to focus on is probably where the real consumer interest is. People care most about not so much the medium or the method that information is collected, but how information is used. And that's why our laws tend to focus on the use of sensitive information like financial and health care and information about kids. And that seems generally to be a kind of pragmatic way of addressing what does seem to be the primary public concern about how information is used as opposed to how it's collected.
David Banisar, your response?
Well, I mean, actually, our laws are possibly the worst on some of the most sensitive areas. Congress has recently passed a bill on financial privacy that has immense numbers of loopholes. In many cases, consumers can't even ask to be removed from lists that are being used by financial institutions. Medical records, after many, many years, the federal government just passed some regulations. They weren't even able, the Congress wasn't able to pass a law on this. And the regulations allow for hospitals and insurance companies and pharmacies and others to use your personal information to market you. They're able to take your prescription information or your clinical information about some drug that you might be taking that could be very sensitive, something on AIDS or, you know, Viagra, and send you a mail saying, you know, hey, you know, you're using Viagra, why don't you use Be Hard instead?
Can you tell us about some of the other forms of surveillance that you're concerned about?
Well, I mean, technology is really driving a renaissance in surveillance, it's a very wide category of things. Everything from in the online world, there was just recently one of the major companies that sells switches started offering software that would allow Internet service providers to watch every move that you do as you surf the net. And then use that information for marketing purposes. There's no consent involved there. There's no P3P, which we think is a bit of a joke. We call it pretty poor privacy. Wouldn't help there. This is something that's going on at the Internet service provider level, and it's being done completely secretly. Similarly, the FBI has a program
called
Carnivore.
Is it actually being used now?
Pardon me?
Is it actually being used now?
Not yet. Okay. As far as I know, they just started selling it.
Well, actually, some ISPs, such as particularly the free ISPs, do in fact build up. Some ISPs, such as the free ISPs, do actually watch where people go and build up profiles. But that's an unusual infrastructure. What this new company, this company suggested doing, was that it become a standard feature of internet service provision. That the user was monitored by name according to his surfing habits and targeted with advertising based on a profile assembled.
But Jason, I mean, the free ISP is kind of a good example. Clearly there's a very express bargain with consumers.
This is Mark Unkefer.
This is Mark. You get
of Information Technology Association.
You get a free Internet access service in exchange for getting a lot of pop-down ads and very focused marketing. That is, for consumers, a very conscious trade-off which they make. Obviously, clearly, a lot of consumers would prefer not to and opt to pay a certain amount per month, but it's a consumer choice issue.
Sure, and I'm happy for consumers to have that choice. However, they should have certain rights there, including the ability to see the profile that is developed and to have it deleted if they choose to terminate the service. They don't have that right now, guaranteed by U.S. law.
Jason Catlett of Junkbusters, what about other countries?
Well, Canada recently passed a very strong, comprehensive privacy law, which gives people exactly those rights, the right to see the profiles and data that's held by companies about them, to delete it, to correct it. It requires consent in many cases, and it limits collection to what the law puts in a rather vague term, what a reasonable person would consider appropriate in the circumstances. The law necessarily has to be vague, but I think that's an important factor because Otherwise, excessive data collection is legal. In other countries around the world, there are also strong privacy laws of that nature, and David Banasar has written a report on this topic, and he might like to comment.
David Banasar of Privacy International.
Well, I looked at what was going on in 50 countries, and about somewhere between 30 and 40 of the world's major industrial countries already have some sort of comprehensive law in place that covers aspects of collecting information and giving consumers basic rights. Canada is one of the most recent examples, but also places like Chile, Argentina, and Paraguay all have passed laws in the last year also. The U.S. is really the last major industrialized country in the world that doesn't have that doesn't provide for basic consumer protections. It doesn't provide for a baseline of protection for protecting your privacy. It really does rely either on very specific laws that protect your video rental records or your cable TV records. Otherwise on self-regulation by industry, which generally has not worked.
Mark Unke,
if I could kind of respond to that, I mean, there is in fact a privacy regulatory system in the United States. It's just different in that it, instead of being comprehensive, it focuses in specific sectoral areas where consumers are the most sensitive. So whereas, say, the European laws affect whether or not you can store information on airline seat assignment preference, the U.S. laws focus, again, we can talk about the specifics of it, but the regulatory system focuses on the specific areas, which I think we would all generally agree tend to be the most sensitive areas for consumers.
But, Mark Unkford, doesn't your trade association, the Information Technology Association of America, oppose these kind of privacy regulations?
Well, our general position, we focus particularly on the Internet, that consumers care about the information as opposed to the medium being used to collect the information. So our sense is that there ought not to be any special rules that apply to the Internet. You can collect just as much information, say, from when a consumer fills out a warranty card and drops it in the post and sends it in. So our feeling, and probably this is one that Jason and David and I would all agree on, is that the rules ought to be apply across the board and should not be exclusive just to a particular medium of collection.
David Banasar, could you explain the pen register warrant in Carnivore? Explain what it is, even for people who don't use the Internet.
Sure. Let me actually say one thing about the U.S. system. As I said before, it's very ad hoc. There are, and it doesn't just cover sensitive things. There are a variety of legislation that isn't comprehensive at all. In some cases, like medical records and financial records, are not covered very well. But on the other hand, your video rental records are covered very well because somebody pulled Bork, Supreme Court nominee Bork's video rental records during his nomination process, so they actually passed the law on that. So it's hard to imagine almost a worse system than the United States, except in places maybe like China and Singapore where they don't have anything at all, because it is technology specific. It is your video rental, it is your cable TV, it is just your phone records, but it doesn't cover anything related to the Internet. And every time a new technology comes in, it's not covered because the way the laws are written, they don't cover the broad scope of things. They don't cover the information, they cover the technology in a lot of cases, and that's a real problem. On the issue of Carnivore, Carnivore is a FBI program. It's basically something running on a more or less a standard personal computer that they then take to an Internet service provider and place on their system so that they can monitor the activities of some particular user. Now, there are a couple different standards for the warrants. When they're supposed to be monitoring people's email, they're supposed to get a full court order based on the Fourth Amendment, based on probable cause. But when they want to monitor somebody's traffic, when they want to monitor what you're browsing, when they want to monitor who you're talking to, how long you're online, they don't actually have to get a real court order. They can get something called a pen register order. And a pen register is an old-fashioned machine that physically monitors a phone line to see what lines or what phones you dial. So if you call your friend Joe, it collects Joe's phone number, but that's it. They're using this pen register warrant to collect information on where you're browsing on the Internet, which can be very sensitive information. If you're visiting AIDS sites, if you're visiting labor sites, if you're visiting political sites of some bent that perhaps your boss or the FBI or whoever doesn't like, that can be very sensitive information. And the kind of order they can get basically says, we can do anything we want. We can collect this. And we don't have to prove that you're a criminal. All we have to do is prove that we're interested in you because there might be some sort of potential case coming up.
Are employers using email monitoring more and more?
It's quite prevalent in the industry, it appears, these days. It's being done at the server level, and this is another area where there are no legal protections. Employers are not even required to tell their employees that they're doing the monitoring.
On that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Very interesting conversation. David Banasar of Privacy International, your website?
It's www.privacyinternational.org.
Jason Catlett of Junkbusters, yours?
www.junkbusters.com.
And Mark Unkefer of the Trade Association, Information Technology Association of America?
Sure, www.itaa.org.
Thanks all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Only 2 days after Ariel Sharon won power, Israel has rejected a Palestinian call to pick up peace talks where they left off. A new Israeli advisor said today, everything that was spoken about or said before is not binding on Israel or any government. We turn right now to Professor Edward Said. He's an Institute Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He spoke last year in a joint address along with Professor Noam Chomsky about the Middle East. Said's autobiography is called Out of Place, a Memoir.
Not to hold back my conclusion, which is roughly the same as Noam's, I want to say also that my feeling is that the two-state solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is I think, a hopeless one, and some form of binationalism, which I'll try to get to at the end of my comments, seems to me to be the only hope, and hence the reason for talking about it more in this country. I've just come back a couple of weeks ago from a trip where I spent some time in Israel, as well as, of course, in the Palestinian territories, and spoke about this to some degree of response from Israelis. I mean Israeli Jews, and of course Israeli Palestinians. But what I want to do today is to talk a little bit about the importance, the continuing importance of 1948 for the present moment. And in a sense, I want to talk about something quite different than what you've heard from Noam Chomsky. That is to say, I want to talk about the Palestinian experience as a human, evolving human thing, trajectory, and how it feeds into the current impasse and where it might, if looked at honestly within the Arab and international context, might give one some hope for the future, which I think is the most important thing. I might as well begin by speaking personally about 1948, particularly at a moment when the media is focusing so much on the faces and the bodies and general appalling plight of Kosovar refugees, and what it meant for many of the people around me. My own immediate family was spared the worst ravages of what we call the catastrophe in Nakba of 1948. We had a house and my father a business in Cairo, so even though we were in Palestine during most of 1947, when we left in December of that year, the wrenching, cataclysmic quality of the collective experience, when 780,000 Palestinians, two-thirds of the population, were literally driven out of the country by the Zionist forces of the time. This was not one we had to go through in as traumatic a form as most others did. I was 12 at the time, so I had only a somewhat attenuated and certainly no more than a semi-conscious awareness of what was happening. Only this narrow awareness was available to me, but I do distinctly recall some things with special lucidity. One was that every member of my family on both sides became a refugee during the period. No one remained in our Palestine, that is, that part of the mandatory territory controlled by the British Mandate. That didn't include the West Bank, which was in 1948 annexed to Jordan. Therefore, those of my relatives who lived in cities like Jaffa, Safed, Haifa, and West Jerusalem, which is where I was born, were suddenly made homeless, in many instances penniless, disoriented, and scarred forever. I saw most of them again after the fall of Palestine, but all were greatly reduced in circumstances, their faces stark with worry, ill health, despair. My extended family lost all its property and residence, and like so many Palestinians of the time, bore the travail not so much as a political, but as a natural tragedy. This etched itself on my memory with lasting results, mostly because of the faces, which I had once remembered as content and at ease, but which were now aligned with the cares of exile and homelessness, which is the condition of most Palestinians today. Many families and individuals had their lives broken, their spirits drained, their composure destroyed forever. In the context of seemingly unending serial dislocation, this was and still is for me of the greatest poignancy. One of my uncles went from Palestine to Alexandria to Cairo to Baghdad to Beirut, and now in his 80s lives a sad, silent man in Seattle. Neither he nor his immediate family ever truly recovered. This is emblematic of the larger story of loss and dispossession which continues today, and I think it ought to be mentioned that ever since 1948, the United Nations, just as NATO is saying today, and the United States along with it, ever since 1948, the United States, with the United Nations, has voted a yearly resolution saying that the Palestinians can go back. The second thing I recall was that for the one person in my family who somehow managed to pull herself together in the aftermath of the catastrophe, my aunt, Palestine meant service to the unfortunate refugees, many thousands of whom ended up penniless, jobless, destitute, and disoriented in Egypt. She devoted her life to them in the face of government obduracy and sadistic indifference. From her, I learned that whereas everyone was willing to pay lip service to the cause, to the humanitarian cause, only a very few people were willing to do anything about it. As a Palestinian, therefore, she took it as her lifelong duty to set about helping the refugees. This is in the days before UNICEF and USAID and all of those other things, getting people, children into schools, getting them doctors, giving them treatment and medicine, finding the men jobs, and so on and so forth. She remains an exemplary figure for me, a person against whom any effort thereafter is always measured and always found wanting. The job for us in my lifetime was to be literally unending. It's now 51 years. And because it derives from a human tragedy so profound, so extraordinary, and saturating both the formal as well as the informal life of its people, down to the smallest detail. Has been and will continue to be recalled, testified, remedied. For Palestinians, a vast collective feeling of injustice continues to hang over our lives with undiminished weight. If there's been one thing, one particular delinquency committed by the present group of Palestinian leaders for me, it is their gifted power of forgetting. When one of them was asked recently, this appeared on the front page of the New York Times last October, what he felt about Ariel Sharon's accession to Israel's foreign ministry, given that Sharon was responsible for the shedding of so much Palestinian blood, this leader said blithely, "We are prepared to forget history." And this is a sentiment I neither can share nor, I hasten to add, easily forgive. It's therefore important to recall what Israelis themselves have said about the country they conquered in 1948. Here's Moshe Dayan, 1969, April, just about 30 years ago today. "We came to this country which is already populated by Arabs, and we are establishing a Hebrew that is a Jewish state here. In considerable areas of the country," the total area of the country that he's talking about, it was only 6%, "we bought the lands from the Arabs. Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You don't even know," he was talking to an Israeli audience, "you don't even know the names of these Arab villages, and I don't blame you, because these geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. In the events of 1948, 400 villages were destroyed and effaced from history. Nahalal, which is Dayan's own village," he says, "arose in the place of Mahalul, Givat in the place of Jibta, Kibbutz Sered in the place of Hanif's, and Kfar Yehoshua in the place of Tel Shammam. There's not," this is the last sentence of his intervention, "there's not one place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population." Looking back on the reactions in the aftermath of 1948, what strikes me now is how largely unpolitical they were, as it must be the case for people going through what some of the refugees are going through today. For 20 years after 1948, Palestinians were immersed in the problems of everyday life with little time left over for organizing, analyzing, and planning. Israel, to most Arabs, for at least 20 years after 48, and to Palestinians, except for those who remained, was a cipher, its language unknown, its society unexplored, its people and the history of their movement largely confined to slogans, catch-all phrases, negation. We saw and experienced its cruelty towards us, but it took us a long while to understand what we saw and what we experienced. The overall tendency throughout the Arab world, and this is one of the most important consequences of 1948, as I'm sure it will be in regions of the world that are going through the same process today, is that a vast militarization took over every society, almost without exception, as it did also take over Israel. In the Arab world, military coups succeeded each other more or less unceasingly. And worse yet, every advance in the military idea brought an equal and opposite diminution in social, political, and economic democracy. Looking back on it now, the rise to hegemony of Arab nationalism allowed for very little in the way of democratic civil institutions, mainly because the concepts and the language of that nationalism devoted little attention to the role of democracy in the evolution of these societies. Until now, the presence of a putative danger to the Arab world has engendered a permanent deferral of such things as an open press, unpoliticized universities, or freedoms to research, travel in, and explore new realms of knowledge. No massive investment was ever made in the quality of education, despite on the whole successful policies by some governments, including the Egyptian government, to lower the rate of illiteracy. It was thought that given the perpetual state of emergency caused by Israel, such matters, which could only be the result of long-range planning and reflection, were luxuries that were ill-afforded. Instead, arms procurement on a huge scale took the place of genuine human development with negative results that we live until today. It's worth mentioning that 60% of the world's arms are now bought by Arab countries. Along with the militarization went the wholesale persecution of communities, preeminently but not exclusively the Jewish ones in the Arab world and, of course, the Arab ones inside Israel. And this idea of homogenizing societies to create, in the case of Israel, a Jewish state, in the case of the various Arab states, entirely Arab states, whether they're called Syria, Jordan, Egypt, etc., has had the most wasteful and, in my opinion, terrible results, one of the tragedies of the politics of identity, which ensued. The expulsion of whole communities as a result of 1948, which set in process a system of distortion within the societies, whether it was inside Israel or in the Arab world, most of it encouraged by U.S. policy at the time, seems to me to have led to every conceivable disaster in the way of human formations and social institutions. Nor was this all. In the name of military security in countries like Egypt, there was a bloody-minded, imponderably wasteful campaign against dissenters, mostly on the left, but independently-minded people, too, whose vocation as critics and skilled men and women was brutally terminated in prisons, fatal torture, and summary executions. As one looks back at those things, in the context of 1948, it's the immense panorama of waste and cruelty that stands out as the immediate result of the war itself. Along with that went a scandalously poor treatment of the refugees themselves. This is a kind of the micro history of some of the things that Noam was talking about. It's still the case, for example, that the 40 to 50,000 Palestinian refugees who are resident in Egypt must report to a local police station every month. Vocational, educational, and social opportunities for them are curtailed, and the general sense of not belonging adheres to them despite their Arab nationality and language. In Lebanon, the situation is worse still. Almost 400,000 Palestinian refugees have had to endure not only the massacres of Sabra, Shatila, Tel Zatar, Dbayi, and elsewhere, but have remained confined in hideous quarantine for almost two generations. They have no legal right to work in at least 60 occupations. They are not adequately covered by medical insurance. They cannot travel and return. They are objects of suspicion and dislike. In part, they have inherited the mantle of opprobrium draped around them by the PLO's presence there, and thus they remain in the eyes of many ordinary Lebanese a sort of house enemy to be warded off and or punished from time to time. A similar situation in kind, if not in degree, exists in Syria. As for Jordan, it was, to its credit, the only country where Palestinians were given naturalized status. A visible fault line exists between that disadvantage, the disadvantaged majority of Palestinians and the Jordanian establishment. I might add, however, that for most of these situations where Palestinian refugees exist in large groups within one or another Arab country, all of them as a direct consequence of 1948, 51 years ago, no simple, much less elegant or just solution exists in the foreseeable future. It's also worth mentioning, or rather asking why it is that a destiny of confinement and isolation has been imposed on a people who quite naturally flocked to neighboring countries when driven out of theirs, countries which everyone thought would welcome and sustain them. Inside Israel, the treatment of the Arab minority that was left over, 120,000 that have now become 1 million, a little over a million today, Arab citizens or Palestinian citizens of Israel, they were subject to military government until 1966. Since that time, they are treated as aliens, although they're citizens of the state, non-Jews in the juridical classification by which Israel tries to be a Jewish state unsuccessfully. And essentially, they live in a state of inferior rights. Much less is spent on their villages and schooling and municipal facilities and comparable groups within the Jewish community. And most important, they are denied fundamental rights like those of immigration and citizenship rights that are enjoyed by Jews outside of Israel. Israel has become unique in the sense that it's the only state in the world that is not the state of its citizens, but the state of the entire Jewish people, which means that roughly 1.2 million of its citizens are somehow inferior, not somehow, but are definitely inferior. In the occupied territories, to continue this sad litany of the condition of Palestinians, until the Oslo Accords, Palestinians were ruled as an occupied population with great, by the way, with great admiration by people in this country. I remember in the early 70s, there was a visit to this campus by an Israeli military officer in charge of some aspect of the occupation. And it was a closed seminar, and somehow I wormed my way into it to listen to him say it. And what struck me was the admiration, not to say deference, shown him by faculty members, colleagues of mine in some instances, who were going on about how benign the occupation was.
Professor Edward Said will be back with his speech in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with the speech of Columbia University professor Edward Said. His memoir is called Out of Place, a Memoir.
Well, the fact is, of course, that the brutality has continued in all sorts of ways from the beginning, even after Oslo. To this day, land is continually taken from Palestinians, both inside the occupied territories and inside Israel itself. That is to say, since land is held in trust, 90% of the land, 92% of the land of Israel is held in trust for the Jewish people, Arabs cannot buy land, sell it, or lease it. And their land is continually confiscated. Last fall, for example, the village of Umm al-Fahm, which is the second largest Palestinian village inside Israel, I mean the second largest city, lost approximately 10,000 dunams, which is about 3,000 acres, because Israel unilaterally decided to take them for use as a military target practice area. So this continues all the time. And on the West Bank and Gaza, ruled under military occupation until Oslo, there have been in Gaza about 1,000 laws passed, occupiers' laws, restricting movement, restricting occupations, restricting such things as whether you can plant certain plants or not, whether you can build or not. All aspects of life controlled minutely by the Israeli occupation, 1,400 laws of that sort on the West Bank. creating, in fact, a vast prison. Since Oslo, I'll come back to it in a minute, since Oslo, the situation has gotten worse in ways that I want to describe in a moment. So what happened then after 1948 was the creation, and I want to talk a little bit about the parallelism between the developments inside the Arab world, and particularly as they affected the Palestinians, and the development in developments inside Israel. There was, of course, in the Arab world, a cult of the army, following on the general militarization that I was talking about earlier. This implied that there were only military solutions to political problems, and it was so prevalent a view that it overshadowed the axiom that successful military action had to derive from a motivated, bravely led, and politically integrated and educated force, and this could only issue from a citizen society. Such a desideratum was never the case in the Arab world, rarely practiced or articulated. In addition, there was consolidated a kind of nationalist culture that encouraged rather than mitigated Arab isolation from the rest of the modern world. Israel was soon perceived not only as a Jewish, but as a Western state, which in part it was, and as such was completely rejected even as a suitable intellectual pursuit for those who were interested in finding out about the enemy. And what then developed was a kind of dual system. On the one hand, you had the official Arab position towards Israel, which was rejection, which was, this is the enemy, we have to attack, and so on and so forth. And another system, perfectly typified in that of the Hashemites, but also not limited to them, that is to say, Abdel Nasser, we know, was in contact with the Israelis searching for terms of peace, really all through the 50s and right up to and certainly after the 67 war. The Hashemites were in constant touch with the Israelis and developed an alliance that was never officially accepted or recognized, but it existed and came into play, as Noam mentioned, in 1970 during the Black September days in the war between the Palestinian resistance movement and the Jordanian army. At the same time, Israel, in its extraordinary and compared to the Arab efforts, I mean far superior efforts at international propaganda, was putting out a tissue of ideological fictions, which were never countered and never properly addressed by the Arabs. So that the rhetorical conflict was a consequence of 1948 and amplified well beyond it anything like anywhere else in the world. For part of the time, it took on some of the vehemence and prominence of the Cold War, which framed it for almost 30 years. What was strange about it is, like the events of 1948 themselves, there was no real Palestinian representation at all until 1967. We were always referred to as the Arabs. And the subsequent, after 67 and the subsequent emergence of the PLO, things began to change. Until then, we were simply known as the Arab refugees who fled because their leaders told them to. Even after some research in the early 60s utterly disputed the validity of those claims and proved the existence of Plan Dalit, which was the Israeli army or the Haganah plan to rid Palestine of its inhabitants during the fighting of 1948, in which the aforementioned Rabin, General Rabin, was responsible for the forced eviction of 60,000 people from the towns of Lid and Ramleh, which now are part of Tel Aviv Airport. So when you go there, you might remember that these used to be Arab cities that were emptied in 1948. These stories about the heroic independence and liberation forces of the Zionists continued to be traded in. Worse yet, those Palestinians who remained behind in Israel after 1948 acquired a solitary status as Israeli Arabs. That's what they were called, shunned by other Arabs, treated by Israeli Jews under a whip, the military administration, and until 1966, stringent emergency laws applied and assigned to them as non-Jews. One of the most unfortunate aspects of this state of affairs is that even the word peace acquires a sinister, uncomfortable meaning for the Arabs at just the time that Israeli publicists used it at every opportunity, as, again, the United States did in formulating this notion of a peace process. The Israelis would constantly appear, people like Abba Iban and others, in the West saying, we want peace with the Arabs. And sure enough, the echo went around that Israel fervently desired peace, while the Arabs, ferocious, vengeful, gratuitously bent on violence, did not. In fact, what was at issue, and I want to emphasize this, between Israelis and Palestinians was never peace, but the possibility for Palestinians of restitution of property, nationhood, identity, all of them blotted out by the new Jewish state. Moreover, it appeared to Palestinians that peace with Israel was a form of exterminism that left us without political existence. It meant accepting as definitive and unappealable the events of 1948, the loss of our society and homeland. So even more alienated from Israel and everything it stood for, the whole idea of separation between the two peoples acquired a life of its own, though it meant different things for each. Israelis wanted it in order to live in a purely Jewish state, freed from its non-Jewish residents both in memory and in actuality. Palestinians wanted it as a method for getting back to their original existence as the Arab possessors of Palestine. The logic of separation has operated since 1948 as a persistent motif and has now reached its apogee and its logical conclusion in the hopelessly skewed and unworkable Oslo Accords that are still celebrated by the media and many bien-pensants in this country. At only the very rarest of moments did either Palestinians or Israelis try to think their histories and cultures inextricably linked, for better or for worse, together, contrapuntally, rather than in mutually exclusive terms. The sheer distortion in views both of history and of the future has resulted is breathtaking and requires some example and analysis now. I don't think anyone can honestly disagree that since 1948, the Palestinians have been the victims, Israelis the victors. No matter how much one tries to dress up or prettify this rather bleak formulation, its truth shines through the murk just the same. The general argument from Israel and its supporters has been that the Palestinians brought it on themselves. Why did they leave? Why did the Arabs declare war? Why did they not accept the 1947 plan of partition? And so on and so on. None of this, it should be clear, justifies Israel's subsequent official behavior, both towards itself and its Palestinian victims, where a hard cruelty, a dehumanizing attitude, and an almost sadistic severity in putting down the Palestinians has prevailed over all the years. The much vaunted Israeli and general Jewish feeling that Israel is in serious peril and that Jews will always be targets of anti-Semitic opportunity, that is buttressed by appeals to the Holocaust, to centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, and to Jewish exiles, this is a potent and in many ways a justifiable sentiment. I've gone on record as saying that it is justified for Jews, even for American Jews, whose experiences have been nowhere near as traumatic as their European counterparts, to feel the agonies of the Holocaust as their own, even into the present. But I keep asking myself whether the use of that feeling to keep Palestinians in more or less permanent submission can repeatedly be justified on those grounds alone. And are Netanyahu's intemperate harangues about Israeli security justified, given what a miserable lot has been the Palestinians? Are the huge numbers of soldiers, you must think that in Israel every young person, man or woman, between the ages of 18 and 25 is required to serve in the army. A lot of that service is policing Palestinians, policing the occupation. Are the huge number of soldiers, the obsessive, excessive measures about terrorism, the endless fencing in, one of the things that struck me when I first went to Israel in 1992, was that every open space, including tennis courts and swimming pools, was surrounded by barbed wire. The interrogations, the legal justification of torture. Israel is the only state, to my knowledge, in the world where torture is legally justified as part of interrogation, including shaking. And I have to tell you from my own experience, I haven't been tortured, but I have to tell you that one of the treatments I had for my illness last summer included as one of its perhaps the worst of all side effects for me was what is known as shaking chills, where you shake uncontrollably. And I felt after a few minutes of these shaking chills, which were uncontrollable, that I was going to die. Well, they are regularly used and approved by the Israeli Supreme Court as a way of dealing with, quote-unquote, Arab suspects, Palestinian suspects. This is part of what exists today within Israel. Does all of this, including the nuclear, biological, and chemical options, the continued discrimination against Israeli Palestinians, the fear and contempt, the bellicosity, one could go on, are all these things not a sort of massive distortion in perception and mode of life, all of them premised on and fueled by the extreme separatist, not to say xenophobic, sentiment that Israel must remain at all costs an endangered, isolated, unloved Jewish state? Doesn't one have the impression that the language and discourse that have resulted, there are exceptions, of course, not every Israeli is what I'm describing here, but that generally signifies a refusal to engage, the rejection, to engage with a common regional history except on these extreme separatist terms. So what is the situation now? The modern history of the struggle for Palestinian self-determination can be regarded as an attempt to set right the distortions in life and language inscribed so traumatically as a consequence of 48. There's never been any shortage of Palestinian resistance. And while it's true that there have been some advances here and there in Palestinian struggle, the general movement has either been much slower than that of the Zionists, or it has been regressive, and in Lebanon and Jordan, destructive. We must admit these as shameful episodes in our post-1948 national existence. Where the struggle over land is concerned, and that's the essence of the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians, it is the struggle over the territory, over the land of Palestine, which is a tiny place, there has been a net loss, as Israel, through belligerent as well as other means, has asserted its actual hold on more and more of Palestinian land. I speak here, of course, of sovereignty, military power, actual settlement. I contrast that with what I shall call Palestinian symptoms of response, such as the multiple rhetorical attempts to assert the existence of a Palestinian state, which Chairman Arafat is going around the world trying to do now, to bargain with Israel over conditions of Israeli security, and the general untidiness, sloppiness, and carelessness, the absence of preparations, the absence of maps and files, fact and figures amongst Palestinian negotiators in the Oslo process that have characterized what can only be called a lack of seriousness in dealing with the real as opposed to the rhetorical conditions of dispossession. These have been imposed on us by the current peace process. These multiply the distortions stemming from the original condition of loss and dispossession. Rather than rectifications, they offer additional dislocations and the reproduction of distortions whose widening effects extend the whole range from war to increasing numbers of refugees, more property abandoned and taken, more frustration, more anger, more humiliation, and so on. To all this, one can add the force of Rosemary Sayers' startlingly appropriate and even shattering phrase, too many enemies. But its poignancy is that Palestinians have, by a further dialectical transformation, become their own enemies through often unsuccessful negotiation and violence.
Professor Edward Said, professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, leading Palestinian intellectual and activist. His autobiography is called Out of Place, a Memoir, and that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!